If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And oh, scissors, it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault. This is for a classic episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind from December of 2016. It's our episode on euphemisms.
Yeah, this is a really, really neat one. And if you haven't heard this episode, there's a lot more to it than you might think. Mm-hmm. There's this drift that occurs. So, you know, obviously a euphemism is rolled out initially as kind of like a, you know, a replacement for a dirtier word or a less proper word. Mm-hmm. But then over time, the euphemism itself becomes the dirty word. Yeah. And new words have to be brought in to replace it. So there's a lot to unpack in this episode, and I think everyone can relate to it.
How come "oh, scissors" never became super dirty?
Yeah. One that we use in my household a lot, and I forget who I stole this from or picked it up from, is to just use the word "cuss" in place of an actual cuss word.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I'll talk to the boy about how it's just hot as a cuss out here, or you know, stuff like that, which is silly. But then it also
runs so cute.
But then it runs the risk in the long term of like cuss will then absorb all of the negative energy.
Uh-huh.
And become the foul word. So that's the world we live in.
All right, let's dive right the cuss in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, I want to talk about my favorite scene in the movie Bram Stoker's Dracula, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Okay, well, there's never a bad time to discuss That particular interpretation of Dracula.
It is a great one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like horrible, but it's also great.
It has some wonderful design in it. I love the suit of armor.
Oh, yeah. And I love some of the painted backdrops and mm-hmm. stuff. But there's a great scene where, so you know the basic story of Dracula. These characters are in, I think, late Victorian England, and Dracula, Count Dracula, comes to England from Transylvania and begins feeding on the locals in England. And there is the character Van Helsing, the vampire slayer, man of great wisdom. And in the Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola version, he is played by Anthony Hopkins in a wonderfully weird, hyperactive performance. And there's a scene where the main character's friend Lucy has been turned into a vampire by Count Dracula, and Van Helsing and his associates have just come back from slaying the vampire version of their friend Lucy. And the character Mina Harker, played in the movie by Winona Ryder, she asks, how did Lucy die? Was she in great pain? And Anthony Hopkins, as Van Helsing, says, yes, she was in great pain. Then we cut off her head, drove a stake through her heart, and then burned it, and then she found peace. And I always love that because of the last line at the end there, and then she found peace.
Yeah, everything else is thoroughly non-euphemistic. It's pretty straightforward. These are the steps we took to tear her corpse apart, to kill her undead, unnatural life.
Right, but then you have to end it with a euphemism.
Yeah.
So they have these terms ready at hand. She found peace. She passed on. She went to a better place. These are the friendly terms for death. He could have just finished as he began by saying, and then she died screaming.
Yeah.
But instead, he uses the euphemism, and then she found peace. And it's a great contrast. It's why it's such a wonderful comic moment. But it makes you aware of the absurdity of the euphemisms that we use in everyday language.
Yeah, I feel like in researching this episode, we both had to do a lot of self-examination regarding our own use of euphemisms.
Mm-hmm.
Just how ubiquitous euphemistic language is.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
I bet it's half of all the talk you do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the concept of a euphemism is, if you're not familiar with the word, it just means using a friendlier or more acceptable term to express an idea that for some reason is taboo or uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about it in terms of having a 4.5-year-old in the house.
Yes.
Because he does not have a great use of euphemisms yet.
He's very blunt.
Right. When he'll be eating dinner and he'll say, I need to go poop. I'll be right back. He'll even lay out a detailed plan. I'm going to go poop and I'm going to wash my hands and I'm going to come back. And then I'm going to finish eating. And
wouldn't it be great if we could do that during dinner parties?
Yeah. No. Like if an adult did that, you would just think they'd lost their mind or just were the most uncouth person imaginable, right? But a child is completely free of this. But yeah, we would use a euphemism. We would say, I need to go use the restroom. I'm going to go make use of the lavatory.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe you
visit the water closet.
Yeah.
I'm going to step out.
Yeah. I'm going to. Well, that's a weird one. I've never heard anyone use that. I'm going to step out. Like, where are you going to do if you're going to step out?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's something you don't want to talk about.
Yeah, I tend to fall back on, I'm going to go visit the restroom, or I'm going to go use the restroom, and I'll be right back.
Visit, like you're going to have some quality time with
it. Well, I'm keeping it vague as to what. I'm not going to give you the particulars of what's going to happen. Maybe I'm just washing my hands. Maybe I need to blow my nose.
I might just stare in the mirror without blinking.
Yeah, but I'm not going to say, I'm going to go poop, and then I will return. Yeah.
I bet there's a lot of stuff when you have a kid in the house that you have to do euphemistically that you're used to talking more bluntly maybe with mm-hmm. your spouse or partner. But once a kid comes along, you can't say everything the way you used to.
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of back and forth too with kids regarding especially euphemisms regarding the human body.
Right.
Because some parents will fall into this habit of using like cutesier, less accurate terminology for parts of the body, particularly genitalia.
Which I always find creepy when I hear. No offense to parents who do that. I'm mm-hmm. I'm not actually judging you. That's just my instinctual reaction hearing like pee-pee and stuff. It always sounds like ick.
Yeah, yeah. We try not to do that in our household. I mean, everyone can do their own thing by all mm-hmm. means. But yeah, we try and say, all right, penis, testicles, et cetera.
Right.
Because I feel it's important for them to have an accurate understanding of their body, and then to be able to describe their body seriously to say, a physician.
Yeah, if they needed to talk to a doctor, they would need the correct terms.
Yeah, but that's an area where in parenting circles, people kind of go on. You hear arguments on both sides.
Do you ever find yourself like wanting to curse in front of the child, but you have to find another word?
Oh yeah, all the time. Sometimes I don't find that other word. this morning, even driving through traffic, and my son reminded me, said, "They can't hear you." And I guess it's true. The other drivers cannot hear me.
That is a perceptive kid.
Yeah. But I do try and use certain euphemisms, or just it's almost easier for me to just come up with a nonsense word. So referring to other drivers as Dumbledores or calling them crab drivers or something like that.
Crab drivers, that's good.
Because they're kind of, you know, they're scuttling around back and forth side to side instead of going in straight lines. Like I find that easier to do because sometimes it's difficult to make a euphemism stick because if I'm really irritated with another driver, my brain really wants to use the F word or the S word or one of these more actually profane words from our vocabulary, and there's something about a watered down version of it just will not suit.
Yeah, it seems to have a power, almost a magical power, and I think maybe that goes back to some deeply rooted part of the curse tradition in our brains, where you know, thousands of years ago, somebody issues a curse, they think that has power.
Yeah.
I think it's actually doing something.
Yeah, it's ding not, dang is not gonna not gonna suit.
Right,
fudge is not gonna work.
So euphemisms in our house, my wife Rachel and I get a lot of enjoyment out of talking about our dog in un-euphemistic terms when people normally would. So one example, when our dog's legs and jaws are jerking in his sleep, you know, he's having little doggy dreams. I think many dog owners would be inclined to say, oh, he's dreaming about chasing something. But we would say, oh, he's dreaming about killing, which he is. He's definitely dreaming about killing little animals.
Huh. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess I do a certain amount of that with our pet as well. I'll give one more example though about raising a child and euphemisms. Is that sometimes you still do not succeed in really driving home the names for things.
Yeah,
and without the proper term, sometimes the children's name for it is going to be totally even more unsuitable. So I don't think I drove home properly, what the anus is to my son.
Okay.
And so one day we had some people guests at the house, and this is someone he hadn't even met before, but he walks outside, just got up from the nap, and he proudly announces, quote, "It itches where poop comes out of my bum." And I think arguably like this is a more uncouth statement. Granted, he's 4 and a half, so nobody cares. But still, it would be more accurate to say my anus itches, right? But in a way, what he said was a euphemism. Really, it's an anti-euphemism, and we'll get into that in a bit.
The euphemism is actually cuter there in the situation where a kid says it.
It's true.
If the kid had said anus, that might have been weirder.
Yeah, but if an adult had said it itches on my bum where poop comes out, then
right.
You would call the authorities.
Exactly. Okay, so let's zoom in on the concept of the euphemism and try to figure out what it does. What is its role in language apart from the obvious? Now, we did say that it's essentially a nice word.
Right.
It's a word that takes the place of a word that for some reason is inappropriate, offensive, something people don't want to say or think about, maybe that conjures up too concrete of an image.
Yeah, I mean, on the surface of things, it's don't say that, say this. But of course, it's more than that. A euphemism has the power to alter the meaning of the word, or at least the spirit and tone of the word,
yeah.
Right? It's like a black and white image versus a colorized image. Euphemisms allow us to colorize our linguistic choices to a certain extent. And I think we can all think of various examples where a euphemism simultaneously makes a word less offensive and yet creepier at the same time, such as many of these genitalia euphemisms that we've been discussing.
Exactly, yeah. Pee-pee. Hearing an adult say it, it's creepy. It even rhymes.
Yeah, I would say most genitalia euphemisms kind of sound like this. They have this vibe of being – at one point they're deflecting us from the thing we're talking about, mm-hmm. and yet colorize it in a way that is distasteful.
Okay, so there are a bunch of different ways that you can come up with a euphemism, right? Like you can put it together in several ways. There's a word that people have instinctually felt somehow they want to start avoiding saying,
mm-hmm.
but they still need the concept in everyday language. You still have to be able to refer to the thing the word refers to somehow. So you've got to come up with a different word. So where do these different words come from?
Well, you can, of course, really go down the rabbit hole figuring out what sort of euphemisms are doing what. But here are some of the basic classifications to consider. There's a term of foreign origin, okay, like a derriere or copulation, urination. You're using a more elegant and foreign term for what you're talking about.
In English, a lot of times the euphemisms kind of come from Latin constructions more so than from the Anglo-Saxon constructions, where the short, straightforward word sounds kind of rude and concrete, and that the Latin origin word sounds more abstract and less like it's less likely to conjure an image.
Right. Another example is abbreviations, for instance, SOB or FUBAR. These are both examples where we simply abbreviate a phrase that would otherwise be offensive to some.
Right. And I guess in most cases you would still consider the abbreviation somewhat offensive, but maybe less so. I don't know. The one I like, you made the note of this, but I like the idea of using really vague abstractions such as doing it.
Doing it. Or the source I was looking at mentioned like situation, like just referring to the such and such situation. One that always has annoyed me is the situation room. Like, what situation is the room for? Is it a war room?
Right.
Because if it's a war room, let's call it a war room.
Right.
Is it an emergency room? Let's call it what it is. The situation room could be about anything.
Okay. There would also be the concept of just saying that you don't want to say a thing, essentially like unmentionables.
Yes, he who should not be named, right?
Right.
For Lord Voldemort. And then there are, of course, mispronunciations like freakin' or God. I guess, is gosh darn it one? Is replacing God with gosh, does that work?
I guess it could be like gall darn it.
Gall darn it. Yeah, that would be one. Yeah. And then there are plays on abbreviation, which I really hadn't thought much of, but bull roar is one that we actually used recently in talking about BS.
Right.
Or just to go ahead and bleep me, bull right? But I don't think I've ever used barbecue sauce. I saw that one listed as well.
Where'd you see that?
It was in one of the papers here that we were looking at. They mentioned barbecue. So I would like to hear from anyone who says, oh, that's just a load of barbecue sauce.
Barbecue
sauce. I've never heard that. It must be a regional thing. What kind of barbecue sauce? Especially if it's regional. North Carolina? South Carolina? I don't know.
Or beasting. Beasting would be a good one.
Oh, is that actually used?
No, I just made that up. No, I was trying to think. What could you? That even has some of the same consonants in it.
Yeah. How about malarkey? Or maybe malarkey is malarkey actually more offensive in its origin? And it's one of these things where we don't know what it means anymore.
I have no idea where it comes from. Huh. It'd be horrible to go look that up later and find out it's a deeply offensive term.
Yeah. And, I feel like that happens a time or two as well. We have something we think is a euphemism, but in reality, we're just using a far more offensive term that fewer people are familiar with.
Okay. But so when you use euphemisms, however you form the new phrase or the new word, you're essentially doing maybe three different kinds of things, right?
Yeah. When you bust out a euphemism, you may be employing what is called circumlocution, to speak around that which cannot be said.
Yeah. Circumlocution. And that's something we often use in a non-euphemistic way too. Like we use it when we're speaking a language we're not very familiar with. If you've ever tried to speak another language, you often don't have the word for a thing.
Yeah.
So instead you circumlocute. You say a bunch of things that are sort of explaining the concept of the word to try to get to it. But this would be a case where you do the same thing not because you don't have the word but because you don't want to use the word.
Yeah. And another example would be taboo deformation. So we're altering the spelling or pronunciation of that which cannot be said. So go fudge yourself, you mother effer.
Right.
That would be an example of the use of taboo deformation.
Or gall darn it.
Yeah, gall darn it. We're just think of the obscenity as this clay object, and we're just wrenching it into a less profane shape. But we still know what its original shape was. It's still echoes that form enough for us to use it, albeit in a blunted form.
Yeah. And I guess the other main thing would be sort of robbing the word of its power to conjure imagery.
Yeah. Doublespeak, right? Making neutral the awful. I think one of the best examples of this is to say the enemy combatant was neutralized, which sounds far nicer than we shot Rolf to death.
Right.
And his family will be without him now. You know, Rolf was hit with an explosive that resulted in complete body defragmentation.
Right.
Which I guess is
That'd be sort of
– That's kind of a euphemism as well, right?
But, right, yeah, defragmentation. What would it be? Rolf was hit by an explosion that severed many arteries.
Yes. but, you know
– It's not that funny. I don't know why I'm laughing.
No. But it's kind of getting – as we try to dance around Rolf's death and even discuss more accurately what happened to Rolf – are some things in life almost like too dreadful? Like there's no way that language, at least brief language, can accurately describe something that is that horrible?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to look at the general categories of things that we have euphemisms for. It's not just arbitrary. It's not like we just have euphemisms for anything.
Uh-huh.
We have euphemisms usually for terms having to do with the inevitable processes of the human body,
right.
like elimination of waste,
mm-hmm.
Sex, and death. Those are the big things that you have euphemisms for, but also for culturally sensitive issues, for names of marginalized groups that are discriminated against,
right.
or something like that.
Yeah, and as well as the way these things are shadowed, and certainly there's a whole area of business euphemism to discuss as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course we have a number of different euphemisms to refer to firing someone, which is kind of the workplace version of death, right?
Oh yeah.
We have, for instance, you may have heard about layoffs,
right?
Downsizing. Right sizing. That's like that's a euphemism on top of a euphemism.
Uh-huh.
Like downsizing, we're not downsizing, we're right sizing. We're just making the organization the correct size for what we're doing here. Headcount adjustment or headcount reduction, an RIF or reduction in force, a realignment.
Oh,
these are all so fabulous, wonderful terms that allow management to do horrible things to people's lives
the worst,
without feeling bad about it.
The worst is let go. It's like you're free.
Oh yeah, we had to let you go. You should be thanking us.
Right.
Yeah.
I think maybe more than anywhere else I go in my life, the business world is absolutely built out of euphemisms.
Mm-hmm.
So. I think a reason for this might be that the business relationship is essentially a cutthroat relationship. Most of the time, if employers can scam customers or employees out of another nickel and get away with it and keep making money, they will do it most of the time. And vice versa. You know, everybody in the business relationship is trying to get an extra nickel and give as little as they can for it. But at the same time, customers and employers and employees interact with one another all the time. You have to see your employer on a regular basis. I mean, most people do. So they want to have pleasant relationships with the people they interact with. So you kind of live in this state of denial about the heartless, cutthroat principle at the foundation of your work relationships. And it's weird trying to be friendly with your boss when you're thinking about the fact that your boss could fire you at any time and in some places for any reason. So we sort of pack our business lives with euphemisms to avoid thinking about this cutthroat reality. In addition to the euphemisms for firing, one thing I was thinking about was, Robert, have you ever noticed that, at least in my experience, maybe in yours too, businesses seem to never want to talk about, quote, money?
Yeah.
So maybe I'm imagining this, but it seems like money is always removed to one higher level of abstraction, like revenue or returns or something like that. And it's as if talking about money directly would reveal that the whole enterprise is kind of tacky at its core.
Or, you know, not only revenue, but rev.
Yeah.
Rev share.
Uh-huh.
Like that's a term that is thrown around a lot in our industry now. And yeah, you talk about rev share, then it's just an item on a sheet. But if you say, I want you to give me more of some of the money that you are getting for the thing that I'm making for you so that you can make money, then it gets a little less tidy, right?
It's like, why are you making it like that? It's like you've said something really mean when you're just saying in direct terms what you're talking about.
Yeah, I often think about we've all read the studies in terms of businesses where corporations are essentially psychopaths. Mm-hmm. I often think of it in terms of like artificial intelligence beings and various cyberpunk stories. So a corporation is essentially this demon, and this demon is bound by whatever chains of law and policy and regulations that we can muster to keep it in check, and then we sort of handle it with specialized gloves, often composed of euphemisms that allow us to handle it,
right,
and benefit from its presence. But there's no denying that it's horrible, demonic nature.
That is a nice analogy.
It comes from, I guess I read one too many Warhammer 40,000 book in my time.
Oh, they have demon gloves for the corporations?
Well, no, they have actual demons sometimes.
Oh, okay.
And they're chained up and they serve the, who is it, the witch hunters, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think we should take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the cultural implications of euphemisms.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
So yeah, we're talking about language here. we have multiple languages throughout the world. Every culture is kind of emerges from its own linguistic world, and therefore we have different uses of euphemism in different languages. We have different uses of euphemism in just different versions of different languages, different dialects.
Right, British English versus American English. And so a lot of our reference points are going to be English, but it is worth looking into the use of euphemisms maybe in other languages too.
Yeah, two great examples I think come from British English and Mandarin Chinese. So the Economist ran a great and naturally unattributed article back in 2011 titled Making Murder Respectable. And it runs through a number of examples of euphemisms that are currently or sort of previously in use. I think some of the British ones have fallen out of favor.
Did you notice that nice euphemism there, unattributed, where the real term would be the author's name is not listed?
Yeah, you would either say the author is anonymous or not credited
right.
for their work. But I mean, that's the Economist business. That's a whole separate discussion. We have a number, of course, American euphemisms, which the author in this article points out that these, of course, just replace non-offensive words terms with new non-offensive words and terms. We'll get into the details on this in a bit, but it entails something that's been referred to as the euphemism treadmill.
Right, by the linguist and general scholar Steven Pinker.
Yeah, yeah. Contemporary, very, very much contemporary, still commenting on the world we find ourselves in today. British euphemisms, on the other hand, they create, quote, a pleasant sense of complicity between the euphemist and the individual that's listening to the euphemist. The first few examples that the author rolls out come from British obits. So a drunkard will be described as convivial or cheery.
That's great.
A nymphomaniac is it has notable vivacity. And in prior times, you would, of course, encountered a homosexual only as a, quote, confirmed bachelor.
With all of these, it's almost as if the person using the euphemism and the person hearing it are sort of in on a joke together.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that the author gets into here too, is you have to be in on the joke to really understand at least proper British conversation.
Yeah.
You have to know the cues. Otherwise, you're gonna have no idea what you're talking about. One more from the obit world, though, is that there's the mysterious burden by occasional irregularities in his private life.
His private life.
Yeah, which is delightfully vague. Like I assume that means scandals, scandal-ridden life, but that's a lot sharper. The author points out that there are a number of passive cues in sort of traditional high British conversation, such as incidentally, Joe, this would mean I am now telling you the purpose of this discussion.
Right.
Even though I'm saying incidentally, as if this is just an incidental point I want to make, I'm actually saying, all right, cut all the crap. This is the real reason we're meeting here today. Another one that the author mentions, with the greatest respect. With the greatest respect, Joe, that means you are mistaken and silly.
Right.
which seems to be the complete opposite of what you're literally saying.
I can think of a Southern American equivalent.
What's that?
Bless his heart.
Bless his heart. Yeah.
His heart. That means sort of the opposite of what it says.
Yeah. I think that's a great example. Now, the author of this Economist piece also pointed out that there are a number of Chinese euphemisms, and these, like American euphemisms, often stem from squeamishness. It's not proper to be too direct, especially if you might offend somebody. So it's this idea of a polite opacity.
Hmm.
So instead of turning down an invitation, and this might be like this can be a really formal invitation, like, you know, a political nature.
Mm-hmm.
One might be told that something is a bu fang bian, which means not convenient. When that, of course, really means we're not doing that. That's not happening.
So it's not like this is a bad time for me. Can we reschedule?
Right. It's very reminiscent of, I imagine everyone out there has some friend or acquaintance that's very flaky, very wishy-washy about their appointments. You say, hey, do you want to hang out this week? Let me check my calendar. Let me see. I'll get back to you. You know, instead of saying,
but sometimes that means that they'll get
sometimes,
back to you.
Yeah, that's the thing. And if you didn't know better, you might have an official inquiry with a Chinese government official, and you might say, oh, well, it's not convenient. I'll try again tomorrow. But right. No, you're not getting the message. It's not convenient. It's not going to happen, perhaps ever. Another example is one might ask for an explanation of something, and you might get buqingzhu, which means I am not clear, which just means you're not going to be told. Like it basically means I can't tell you that or I won't tell you that, but it's casting that in the guise of, well, I'm not really clear on the information. Right. But it also kind of sounds like I am not clear and that I am not
– I am opaque.
I am opaque.
Yeah.
So I find it interesting. There are examples like this in every language, and perhaps our listeners out there, if you have particular examples you're aware of in a tongue that you speak or have some history with, we'd love to hear those examples.
Oh, yeah. I always love hearing the different idioms from around the world that we get from listeners. One of my favorites was we heard from a listener and, oh, now I apologize. I can't remember which language it was. I think it was Swedish or Norwegian or mm-hmm. maybe Scandinavian language,
okay.
And the expression was it was an expression that means something is amiss, mm-hmm. and the term is there are owls in the moss. I love it. That's great.
There are owls in the moss. That's pretty good.
If you're the one who sent that to us, I still think about that a lot. Thank you so much. Okay, well, for one other arena of the interaction between culture and euphemism, I was thinking about what about religious euphemisms? So I sometimes see – here's just one example. I want to talk about a few different examples. One of them is the way some Christians use euphemism to talk about certain doctrines that they haven't explicitly rejected but obviously aren't comfortable talking about directly. And one example that I have encountered before is the Christian doctrine of hell.
Yes.
Now, there are many doctrines of hell, and I don't want to paint all believers with the same view. But one common interpretation throughout the history of the church is the sort of Dante's Inferno interpretation, saying that Dante is more or less correct. After death, people who are non-Christians or people who are unrepentant sinners go to a place of eternal torture and agony in fire. And some modern Christians explicitly deny that premise. They just don't believe in that, or they don't interpret the references to hell that way.
Right. Yeah. We actually have an older Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode on this that goes through some of the theologies. And mm-hmm. I think we have a list or gallery that I can link to on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But yeah, you have everything from this literal interpretation to annihilation theology, which
right.
says when you die, going to hell is essentially you are consumed. Your soul is just completely obliterated.
Yeah. You just cease to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, as you alluded to, some do accept and embrace it and say explicitly what they mean. You know, hell is a place of torment. Depart from me and everlasting fire. But there are some people who at least rhetorically seem stuck in the middle. I hear this fairly often. They don't reject the doctrine, but they don't want to talk about it bluntly. Mm-hmm. So you get phrases that are things like, the unrighteous or the unbeliever will suffer divine judgment or something like that. It's euphemistic in nature. You know, you haven't rejected the belief, but you just don't want to talk about the particulars of it.
That's interesting. So they might believe in this this sort of torture revenge fantasy of hell, but they're using the language of annihilation theology instead. As a euphemism for what they actually believe.
Or just not being specific about what the judgment entails.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are other terms too. That was the first one that came to my mind. But. Huh.
Yeah, it's such a weird area to consider, right? Because so many of these – when you're using a euphemism for your butt, you're talking about a thing that has a definite reality.
Yeah.
There's nothing subjective.
It's not a doctrine or belief.
Right. There is an objective – but there's an objective. There are objective buttocks. There is an anus. There's no denying. There's no denying these things. But when you get into hell, there are all these discussions. There's a broad spectrum of theologies regarding its existence or non-existence. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm personally of the mind that whatever your belief about hell is, you should speak clearly about it.
Another type of religious euphemism, I would say, is motivated by a very different type of thing. Instead of being uncomfortable with certain concepts or not wanting to talk about certain things, it extends from a perception of holiness or reverence. And this is the evolution of the name of God in Judaism throughout history. So it's not that the name of God has changed so much, or at least not much in recent history in Judaism, but that at certain points throughout history, usage of the name has become taboo because of beliefs about not taking the name of the Lord in vain. Mm-hmm. And thus, it is required to have a new word if you want to talk about religious ideas such as your belief in God without referencing this word that you might be using the wrong way. And so some of my info here is coming from a book on Hebrew and Western – the Hebrew and Western Christian Name of God by Robert J. Wilkinson. But in the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish God has several names. You've got names like El and Elyon, Elohim. But the most common is Yahweh, the four-letter word that's often called the Tetragrammaton, meaning four letters. And at a certain point in the history of Judaism, and generally in the Hellenistic period, you know, the Greek conquest, a taboo on pronouncing the name emerged. And so to quote one story about this origin from the Babylonian Talmud, quote, "The Greeks," and that's referring to the Seleucid rulers of the region at that time, "decreed that the name of God may not be spoken aloud. But when the Hasmoneans," and that was a group of Jewish rebels, "grew in strength and defeated them, they decreed that the name of God be used even in contracts." And an example of this might be something like, "By the name of Yahweh, I will paint your chicken coop if you give me a tray of corn muffins." And so but then continuing from the Talmud, "When the rabbis heard about this, they said, 'Tomorrow this person will pay his debt and the contract will be thrown on a garbage heap.' So they forbade its use in contracts." So it wasn't the use of the name that was necessarily inherently wrong. It was just that using it in this way for sort of everyday purposes made it vulnerable to accidental defilement.
Oh, okay. So you have – in a sense, you have a very secular use of divine terminology.
Right.
And it's not proper to throw that around.
Right, to just make up a contract with the name of God in it that you'd end up throwing in the trash.
It's like if you were what's the Clive Barker film where you say the name three times and he shows up.
Candyman?
Candyman, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's like Candyman. You don't want to say Candyman all the time because he'll show up and start killing people, right?
You've got a limited number of times you can invoke that.
Yeah, so we need to have another name for Candyman. You call him sweet guy. Yeah, but then after a while, like there's still Candyman is just so magical and so potent that he's going to creep into that term as well and start popping up when you say that word. So you got to come up with another one.
Yeah, but so anyway, going on in the same spirit of avoiding accidental defilement, some Jews throughout history have avoided saying the Tetragrammaton name out loud. Even in contexts where I would think one would assume it was probably not being defiled, such as in reading of the Torah.
Yeah.
So you might have readings aloud from the Torah where the reader would come to the four-letter name of God, and then instead of saying it, the reader would substitute something like the word Adonai, which means Lord or Master. But then in time, the originally euphemistic Adonai, which was just substituted to avoid saying the original name, also came to be charged with the original holiness of the name of God. And so then later you'd have some Jews referring to God as Hashem, meaning the name. So you have this evolutionary process by which a word is used to avoid disrespect, but then that word sort of becomes worthy of respect in its own right. But then anyway, so according to the Talmud, sometime shortly after the conquest of Alexander the Great, the high priest stopped saying the name of God when giving blessings. And in the Mishnah, which is a work of Jewish rabbinic literature, putting down lots of Jewish oral traditions into writing, the name of God is often avoided and substituted with other words associated with God, like heaven or the place or the Holy One, blessed be he. And so, again, I think these euphemisms are interesting because they're not used to avoid mentioning something unpleasant or offensive, but to avoid accidental defilement of a word that in this religious context is believed to be holy, believed to be treated with reverence and respect.
Huh. That's interesting because I think it's easy to believe that you just have all these different names for God solely because, hey, God's really cool, really important, and has all of these different points in time where people are considering it, and therefore they need a different name for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we see that sort of loose interpretation reflected in our discussion of unreal deities, where so like Gozer the Gozerian has several different names in Ghostbusters,
right?
Probably just because Gozer's cool and needs a number of names, right?
Yeah, it's true. You've lost the original rationale.
Yeah, for all this diversification.
Yeah, but you've still got the process. It's a cargo cult of naming deities.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering, are there similar euphemisms in other religions too? For either one, for talking about concepts that might be uncomfortable to some believers, yet they haven't been fully rejected, or talking about things that cannot be named out of respect?
Yeah, we briefly talked about this before we came in here. We had a hard time nailing down another example. We talked about the devil a little bit.
Yeah.
But
I think that's not exactly the same.
It's not, because there's this timeline in our development of the devil as a concept that's really kind of similar to our concept of hell, mm-hmm. where the devil as the sort of popular conception of the Western devil, or even like the classical devil, or the Miltonian devil, or Dante's devil, like these are all vastly different things, and they occur at different points in our evolving conception of the devil. And even just on a biblical basis, you go back to, say, the book of Job, like that's not the devil. That's
right.
That's some guy who works for God that's called Satan.
Uh-huh.
That I believe stems from the Hebraic Hasatan, which was just a court role.
Yeah, exactly. But then I think we've also not had the same kind of evolution because the devil is not really considered holy.
So, right. Yeah. So, in fact, there's often the opposite effort to really cast the devil down instead and refer to it as a worm or what have you.
Sometime we should do a History of the Devil show.
Oh, yeah, we should.
But anyway, so I want to move on yet again from one totally uncontroversial subject, religion, to another one, politics. So there is definitely a strong cultural import of euphemism in politics, and this probably won't come as a surprise to you, but exactly how it works out you might be a little fuzzy on. And this is something that is you can definitely find explored in a really lucid and fascinating way in the 1946 essay by George Orwell, the English journalist and critic, called Politics and the English Language. And in this essay, which, by the way, is a lot of people might have read it in college as sort of just like a writing style essay, but I think it's a great read. It's just fun to read. He's got a great writing style. And anyway, in this essay, Orwell lays out a series of criticisms as what he saw as the deterioration of the quality of published writing in English in his time. So he's coming right out of World War II. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a victorious Soviet Union to deal with. You've just had the fall of the Nazi regime. The world has been in chaos for a while. But anyway, he's talking about in this climate, the English language has really been put through the ringer. Oh, and I just used a cliche that he would abhor because he attacks the use of cliches like that in his essay. But in one famous passage, Orwell translates a well-written verse from the King James Bible translation of the Book of Ecclesiastes into the style he's referring to in modern English. And I just got to read this because it's too good. The King James Bible says, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all.
Okay.
Orwell's rewriting of that in modern English is, objective considerations of contemporary phenomena compel the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must invariably be taken into account. Now, it does communicate the same sense, basically, right?
Yeah, I almost feel like his translation of it is better. Maybe it I think maybe it just comes from reading too many, you know, god awful peer reviewed papers for work. But I feel like that one kind of drove home a little easier for me.
Oh man, I can't agree with you here, Robert. That is awful. Come on.
Yeah. Hey, you know.
Okay. Well, anyway, so Orwell goes on to say in his main characterization that, quote, modern writing at its worst does not consist in picking out words for the sake of their meaning and inventing images in order to make the meaning clearer. It consists in gumming together long strips of words which have already been set in order by someone else and making the results presentable by sheer humbug. The attraction of this way of writing is that it is easy. And I think there's some truth to that, like that when you use these sort of cliches and bloated phrases, writing comes very naturally. You don't have to think as much about the images or the words you're choosing as you do when you try to write things in a simpler, more concrete way.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's this second example. I instantly thought of peer-reviewed papers because there is this often very specific, clinical, technical discussion of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Often, you know, not all the time, but sometimes this can feel a bit soulless.
Yeah.
But you can read it and you basically know what they're talking about in great detail. And there's less interpretation involved. And so, yeah, it's a less creative venture either to write or to read. But is it more exact?
I don't know if it is, and I think – well, Orwell might disagree with you, but I would like to hear what you think once he's – so I want to get to his main argument, and then maybe you can come back and flog Orwell for me. So for Orwell, the decline in the quality of writing was not just an aesthetic concern. It's not just bad writing that is less enjoyable to read. It is actually a threat against truth, freedom, and social democracy. English, quote, becomes ugly and inaccurate because our thoughts are foolish, but the slovenly of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. And so if you've read Orwell's novel 1984, Robert, I assume you've read 1984.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You'll recall that at the time the story takes place, the totalitarian government in the novel, working under Big Brother, is engaged in the creation of a new form of English known as Newspeak. And in Politics and Language, Orwell says, quote, if thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. And Newspeak in 1984 very much embodies this. It reflects, I think, what Orwell saw as the political power of language. Essentially, control the use of language and you control how people think. Control how people think and you command them to your purpose. And so I want to read one long-ish quote from Politics in the English Language where he really gets to how euphemisms are used in political writing and political journalism. So here is the quote with a few abridgments for length. In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants are driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of the population, or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial, shot in the back of the neck, or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. Consider, for instance, some comfortable English professor defending Russian totalitarianism, and he's talking about Stalinism there. He cannot say outright, "I believe in killing off your opponents when you can get good results by doing so." Probably, therefore, he will say something like this. While freely conceding that the Soviet regime exhibits certain features with which the humanitarian may be inclined to deplore, we must, I think, agree that a certain curtailment of the right to political opposition is an unavoidable concomitant of transitional periods, and that the rigors which the Russian people have been called upon to undergo have been amply justified in the sphere of concrete achievement. The inflated style itself is a kind of euphemism. A mass of Latin words falls upon the facts like soft snow, blurring the outline and covering up all the details. So what do you think about that, Robert?
No, I mean, I agree with that. I guess it comes down to like this kind of writing that we're talking about is it's essentially writing like a machine.
Yeah.
And inviting the reader to think about the topic like a machine, with sort of this without any of these human touches that add humanity to the subject matter, which I think in a scientific environment, like, or certainly in, say, a study about E. coli in a lab experiment, mm-hmm. that's perfectly fair. Like, that's the way to do it.
Oh, sure.
But of course, when you're getting into affairs of politics and war, certainly even domestic politics, people's lives hang in the balance.
Right.
And if you distance yourself with language enough, then you don't have to deal with the actual flesh and blood ramifications of what you're talking about. But then the other side of that is it's somebody's job, right?
Yeah.
To make a better killing machine. It's somebody's job to cut how the funding of public housing.
Right.
So it, of course, they're going to try and do it in a way that makes them feel less icky.
Right. I mean, so Orwell says political language, and he says that this comes from both sides, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. And I think there is a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
I understand the need for it. I'm not saying that it is done purely out of calculating malice. There are people who work in government who do things that you would probably think of as bad, but who don't think of themselves as bad people. And so they've got to come up with some way of getting around this. And it's this circumlocution, or it's this neutralizing language like we talked about earlier, coming up with these abstract terminologies, naming things in terms of processes rather than of consequences. It's not that we killed a guy, but the enemy was neutralized. And for Orwell, I think these types of phrases and euphemisms they're not limited to the rulers themselves, right? They're not limited just to people who want to justify themselves in tyranny and stupefy the masses with this lullaby of empty, denatured language. They're also used by people who should know better. People
yeah.
who might even be critical of those in power. Euphemisms and mushy phrases are used, he emphasizes, because they're easy. They make writing easier and they make thinking about concepts easier. Euphemisms are like a lubricant that just allows you to easily insert your mind into a conversation without struggling with the most difficult implications of it. And for Orwell, this is not just applicable to these political euphemisms, for killing and these horrible acts, but it goes into everyday conversation. So he writes, quote, phrases like "a not unjustifiable assumption" I love that, "leaves much to be desired," "would serve no good purpose," "a consideration which we should do well to bear in mind," are a continuous and he says those are a continuous temptation, a packet of aspirins always at one's elbow. And I really do like that idea of the euphemism as a painkiller.
Yeah, it makes me think. I'm instantly thinking of various recent examples of strong statements about war and the use of war.
Mm-hmm.
in a political climate. And here I'm using euphemisms already to talk about it. But it's like if you have this sentence where you're going to say we are going to eliminate enemy combatants, mm-hmm. right? And if you start removing some of the euphemisms there, you still have to try and make that an acceptable sentence to whoever is saying or listening to it.
Yeah.
So if you replace eliminate with kill, if you replace eliminate with carpet bomb or something like that, and if you then you're still going to have to try and make it a sentence that you can live with. And sometimes that comes. So what else can you change in that sentence? You can change enemy combatants to barbarians. Mm-hmm. You can or any other various form that also dehumanizes what's going on.
Yeah.
But by changing the direction of the dehumanization.
Right. Well, that would be what is known as a dysphemism, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that how you pronounce it? A euphemism would be, you know, it's euphemism comes from you meaning good and feme meaning speech. Mm-hmm. So a dysphemism is the opposite, essentially. You're taking a concept that's inherently neutral and applying a term to it that is a bad filtering term.
Yeah.
It essentially filters out the good imagery or things you might associate with a thing and gives it bad connotations.
Well, what's a good example here of a dysphemism for our listeners?
Oh, how about somebody is not happy with a deal that mm-hmm. they made? You know, they bought a car or something, and they say, "I got ripped off."
Oh, and to take it a step further, they would say, "Oh, I got screwed."
Yeah,
I really got screwed in that deal. Did you really get quote unquote screwed in any of the various interpretations there?
No, you just bought something and you later regretted how much you spent on it or something.
But nay, they have used the screws on my hands and my fingers, and now I have lost the ability to write.
Oh, is that for thumb screws?
Yeah,
I'm thinking
of a very medieval interpretation. Yeah.
Okay, but either way, ripped off. Oh, you didn't. Ripped off means you got robbed.
Yeah.
You didn't get robbed. You made a deal that you later regretted. But that's a dysphemism. It's substituting a more negative connotation word for this originally, you know, more direct term.
And I guess that would be kind of on the outskirts of hyperbole. Like you're not going as far to say this was highway robbery.
Yeah.
But you're getting close.
Yeah. But so there are, just like there are lots of euphemisms in political language, there are some dysphemisms in it too. Like you might find in establishment language, the government itself and the bureaucracies that exist tend to speak in euphemisms to kind of make everything a little smoothed over and a little soothing.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, you might have sort of agitators and radical factions tending to speak in dysphemisms, talking about fairly normal things that you could express in a fairly straightforward way in these just grandly negative terms.
Yeah, I think especially in this Facebook age, everybody can think of strong examples of this.
Yeah.
You know, how is, say, the New York Times explaining the situation, and how is your Uncle Jim explaining the situation, or how is the article that he's linking explaining it?
Very likely. I'd say the New York Times is probably being a little euphemistic. I mean, mm-hmm. even their good writers, they tend to be a little euphemistic, just not putting things in very blunt, harsh terms.
Right.
They might say go to the restroom. It's the going to the restroom of politics.
Yes.
But there's plenty of dysphemism out there on the web. But anyway, I want to come back to Orwell. So the question is sort of so Orwell had these concerns about euphemisms, about their potential for enabling totalitarianism and the threat that they represented to a free social democracy. So my question is, was Orwell's belief in the totalitarian potential of vocabulary correct? In some ways, I'm sort of inclined to agree with him because the examples he gives very much make sense to me by using this sort of denatured, sanitized language to talk about killing people and, you know, doing things that are very harsh and cruel and have real bloody realities and, you know, down in the dirt of reality. I'm sure it makes it easier for people to assent to these things, to sort of just go along with it. We've found some nice words for it. But then again, there are other strong arguments that sort of go against the idea that vocabulary has this much power over our thinking. And I guess we can maybe address these after a break. Do you want to take a break?
Yeah, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the euphemism treadmill as well as the Worfian view and the work of Steven Pinker.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So we were talking about whether this totalitarian potential of vocabulary control is correct. Do words really have this much power to control the way we think? Does language determine thought?
So as linguist Steven Pinker has pointed out, the Orwellian view is really kind of based in what's referred to as the Worfian view.
Right.
This is the work of American linguist Benjamin Lee Worf. No relation to the Klingon. Different spelling, I believe.
Right. Also often known as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
Yes. And to give you a timeline for him, he was 1897 through 1941. That's when he was alive. And so his argument, and then therefore Orwell's argument is, yes, language language is how we think. We think in language. This is the bare bones language is the operating system for the human brain.
Right.
View.
But a lot of cognitive neuroscience now says, I don't know if that view is correct. In fact, it's probably not.
Right. Now, I will say this. This is an important fact to keep in mind about language, is that while spoken language comes to us naturally, we're exposed to it growing up. We simply absorb the words that fill our world, multiple languages even.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same with written language. Written language takes work. We have to trick our brains early on in order to avoid backwards letters, the DB confusion, because our brains inherently try to decipher symbols and letters as three-dimensional objects.
Huh. I never thought about that.
Yeah. I was reading or listening to something about that recently. The point, however, here is that written language is kind of a lie. So grammar rules, dictionaries, all of these attempt to chain that which is free, to solidify the inherently fluid nature of language. Certainly humans have been saying the same things for a very long time and will continue to say the same horrible things, but how we say them changes. The individual words, the cultural weight of those words. And I often think of this in terms of weighted stones placed upon a sheet, okay? Like a sheet that's held taut by individuals.
Pull a sheet tight.
Yeah. This is an exercise that's frequently used to demonstrate how massive planetary objects bend and exert gravitational forces.
Right.
Okay?
So like the sheet is space-time and a rock is an object with mass on
it. Right.
Yeah.
But instead of each stone being a planet, each stone is a word. And unlike actual stones – and unlike words as we might experience them in a dictionary, the weights change. So this is where we get into this idea that Steven Pinker gives us, the idea of the euphemism treadmill, the linguistic process by which euphemisms often become taboo or offensive.
So a euphemism is originally created in order to avoid having to say the taboo or offensive or uncomfortable thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then in time, the euphemism itself takes on the properties of that original word you were trying to avoid.
Yeah. Have you ever played a platform video game where your character has to jump onto a pillar, and once you stand on the pillar, it begins to sink down, perhaps into the muck?
Yeah.
And you have to jump to the next pillar, and that starts doing the same thing?
Right.
And this is how you have to cross this entire expanse of muck?
You've got to keep moving.
Yeah. That's basically what's going on here with the euphemism treadmill.
Polite language. It's got to keep moving.
Pinker says, quote, "The euphemism treadmill shows that concepts, not words, are in charge. Give a concept a new name, and the name becomes colored by the concept. The concept does not become freshened by the name."
So he gives examples of like the progression of terminology for people with disabilities. He starts with the idea that crippled, originally that was not an offensive term. That was a polite term to describe somebody who had a disability. But it took on negative connotations. People began to use it as a mean word to say about people. So then that was moved on. And so we no longer say that, and now we have handicapped. But then that also eventually became perceived as sort of like stale, as a euphemism, I guess.
Right.
And this – I guess it started to take on some of the negative connotations that crippled had acquired and then moved on to disabled. And so you've got this
constant – And I think that differently abled is more of the current version. Like we've moved on again to another pillar in the muck.
Right. So you can – so on one hand, just if you're looking from the outside, you'd be like – constantly moving words around, that seems kind of ridiculous. But it's not when you consider how usage of words happens.
And how language works.
Yeah. I mean if people are using a word with negative connotations, eventually people who want to use that word with positive connotations will want a different word.
Yeah. Another great example of this that's cited is the use of idiot or moron.
Mm-hmm.
These used to be neutral terms.
Right. They weren't insults.
Right. But over time, they became insults, and now they are very much an insult. If you call someone an idiot or a moron, you are using an insult. You are not using a neutral term. So we went from that to retarded, which it feels weird to say it because it is the R word, unless you're using it in very particular circumstances.
Right.
But this was neutral, and then it became an obscene term. And then from here we went to mentally challenged and special. But even these, I feel, are degraded to a large degree, especially special. Like to say someone special, I can't think of any specific examples, but I believe I've heard that used at least flippantly, if not as an outright offense.
Oh, yeah. It is a thing mean kids say now.
Mm-hmm.
Like a mean kid wants to – they'll call another kid special. Children, if you're out there listening – I don't know why children are listening to us, but you should not do that.
Some children probably listen.
That's not very nice. But yeah, again, it shows that so you come up with – and I'd be interested to see if somebody could create a like time lag model of this, like how long after a new non-offensive term is introduced, mm-hmm. does it take before that term takes on some unpleasant connotations? People start using it as a term of insult or abuse, and people who want to speak politely feel like they need a new term.
Yeah.
Like, how long does it generally take?
Yeah. Another example of this, I think, would be in business. So we already talked about the robust use of euphemisms in the business environment. Uh-huh. But also think about the buzzwords, right?
Oh, man.
Those buzzwords, they got to have buzz or they're not buzzwords. And buzzwords inherently lose their buzz. So, you know, everybody might be talking about the I can't even think of what the most recent one has been in our circles. But to take an older one, like there was a time when innovation or storytelling, we are all storytelling.
Storytelling is the one. I hate that these words have been completely destroyed, but I believe they have.
Yeah.
We need new words. And storytelling, come on. I love stories.
Yeah.
Stories are like my favorite thing on earth. But when I hear business leaders talking about storytelling, I'm like, well, okay.
We can't describe it like that anymore. Yeah. Yeah. Because it ends up losing – it loses its punch. It loses its value. In a sense, it loses its holiness.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. It does lose its holiness. And it also comes to stop referring to the thing it originally referred to.
Yeah.
When it basically just means like any talking or writing or any kind of communication can be storytelling. Mm-hmm. That's not storytelling.
Right.
What is storytelling?
Yeah, exactly. Now, to come back to the euphemism treadmill real quick, I also want to point out that I have seen it argued that this is essentially this essentially lines up with Gresham's law in economics, which states that bad money drives out the good.
Huh.
This is named for Sir Thomas Gresham, the financial agent of Queen Elizabeth I. Mm-hmm. And the idea here was that if some coins in circulation are pure silver and others are less pure, people are going to spend the bad coins if they're going to keep the good ones for themselves.
Oh, what do you know?
Yeah.
So that makes sense to me. That correlation with the euphemism treadmill. But also, you have a note here, Robert, about a different kind of treadmill that I found interesting.
Yeah, we've already mentioned dysphemisms. There is a dysphemism treadmill as well.
Okay.
And the example that that comes up is "that sucks."
Okay.
"That sucks" stems from a more specific statement that is also still in use, but a more offensive one.
Right.
You can say something sucks, and it's, you know, it's in kids TV shows, but
yeah.
You know, it's on, you know, whatever's on Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network during the day when children are watching. But they're not going to say what something is sucking.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I remember saying "that sucks," thinking it was a totally non-offensive phrase, and having a teacher tell me, you know, if I'd said that word, it would have been like I said a word that rhymes with it.
Yeah.
That was what he was saying, that is a really, really offensive term. But it wasn't like that to me. And it was it had lost its dysphemistic qualities.
Yeah. And it's one of those too. When you start peeling it apart, it's like, why is that a state? Why is that bad? I don't know. It's we get all our sexual politics wrapped up in how you feel about the latest X-Men movie.
Another one I can think of, though we can edit this out if it's way more offensive than I think. But,
okay.
But I think one is the British English expression "bloody," which I think used to be considered incredibly offensive.
It was
like a highly offensive expletive, and now is an incredibly mild expletive, that so much so that it can appear in Harry Potter books and stuff.
Yeah, I wonder. I've never looked into it, but I've often wondered, like, to what extent is it still a little more offensive in British circles than it is in American? Because so much American usage of it, we're just aping British usage of it without really having a strong cultural understanding, maybe, of what is being said.
That's a good question again. Maybe we're yet again doing the cargo cult of euphemisms.
Yeah, and you kind of get, I guess, into the currency equivalencies of different insults.
Right. Or this wouldn't be of euphemisms, the cargo cult of expletives.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's come back to what we started talking about with the idea of the Whorfian view in Orwell. So we've got this other argument from Pinker and from, you know, cognitive neuroscience and all this, who says – they say, you know, the words don't really matter actually all that much. Mm-hmm. Words don't have this power. But I don't feel that.
Right.
I feel very strongly that Orwell was on to something.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually found a paper that gets into this a bit. It's very good. It's available. It's readily available online. 2008 paper by Stanford's Daniel Casasanto. It's published in the journal Language Learning. And the title is Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wharf? Cross-Linguistic Differences in Temporal Language and Thought.
So this is addressing the Wharfian view that language in some way determines or influences thought.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I'm not going to say he takes a middle-of-the-road approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely more in Pinker's direction. He's not saying that the Wharfian view is valid completely,
yeah,
but that what he is saying is that we can't completely dismiss the power of this Wharfian relationship between thoughts and words.
Okay, so maybe that words don't totally determine thoughts, but they have some kind of influencing relationship.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I'll read just a quick quote from this article to really drive this home. Why should we continue to do Wharfian research? One possible reason is that cataloging cross-linguistic cognitive differences could be a step toward charting the boundaries of human biological and cultural diversity. If this is the goal, then the Wharfian effects most worth finding should be extreme instances in which differences between languages produce radically different experiences of reality in their speakers. Alternatively, cross-linguistic cognitive differences could be tools for investigating how thinking works and, in particular, for investigating the role of experience in the acquisition and representation of knowledge. If people who talk differently from correspondingly different mental representations as a consequence, then mental representations must depend in part on these aspects of linguistic experience. If discovering the origin and structure of our mental representations is the goal, then cross-linguistic cognitive differences can be informative, even if they are subtle and even if their effects are largely unconscious. Whether or not they correspond to radical differences in speakers, conscious experiences of the world, Wharfian effects can have profound implications for the study of mental representation.
Okay, so yeah, he is taking – maybe I would call that a middle view. Even if he's saying like the Wharfian hypothesis that language determines thought is wrong, there's still influences that are worth investigating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would say that, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the point. Like essentially that language is still too powerful. It's too ubiquitous. It's – playing some sort of role. It's just to what extent and in which cases it's most transformative.
Interesting. Well, so I wanted to end by thinking about a little more about what is the effect of using euphemisms on our minds and on our culture because when you come up with terms like, you know, the euphemism treadmill, I'm not saying Pinker necessarily meant it this way. I detect a little bit of amusement on his part.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying he definitely meant it to be a term of derision. But you do get this idea of a treadmill being a thing, this sort of like useless cycle.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily useless according to some thinkers. And I wanted to talk about an essay done for Aeon magazine in 2016 by the Columbia University linguistics professor John McWhorter. And so he starts by recognizing Pinker's concept of the euphemism treadmill, and he gives a lot of really great examples of these types of treadmills throughout history. Like we talked about, he talks about the evolution of the concept of welfare. Welfare originally being like, home assistance and then welfare and then cash assistance, where each time there's a new term, it sort of starts to take on mean classist connotations.
Right.
And then you need a new term because it starts to be used as a term of abuse. But for McWhorter, he says this treadmill is not only inevitable but pretty much good in his words – a healthy process necessary in view of the eternal gulf between language and opinion. And he says basically that thought changes more slowly than word usage, but it eventually catches up. And this requires that in a civilized society, people are going to frequently want to change their euphemisms. It's an inevitable thing, and it reflects people's desire to be polite and civilized toward one another.
Except, of course, on the internet where one does not have to be polite or civil. But that's a whole separate discussion right there.
Right. Of course, you're always going to have people who want to defy. But near his conclusion, he says, quote, The euphemism treadmill, then, is neither just a form of bureaucratese nor of identity politics. It is a symptom of the fact that however much we would like it to be otherwise, it's easier to change language than to change thought.
In a sense, it's like you're simply asking someone, look, I know you're not going to stop being awful anytime soon, but if you could at least use language that doesn't wear your awfulness on your sleeve, that would be great. And maybe in time, that outward decency will bleed through to some semblance of inner decency, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, again, earlier we talked about euphemisms being a painkiller or also being a lubricant. And mm-hmm. in this sense, it might be both of those things. Maybe euphemisms or finding a nicer new word for a word that has taken on negative connotations, if that's what a euphemism is, I guess,
right.
it might not solve the underlying problem. It might not fix people's attitudes, but it might just be exactly what it seems like. It's a lubricant. It's a painkiller. It makes interacting in society easier, makes people get along a little bit better.
I can't help but think of the term African-American, the adoption of that term to replace various other terms for black American citizens has a it drives home the fact that this is your fellow American. This is mm-hmm. this is an American, and they have a particular origin, just as you and your Caucasian or Asian or what have you, just as your family has an origin somewhere else as well. Like they are, these individuals are not that different from you.
So do you think that that term actually helps people change their way of thinking, or is it just this lubricant that makes it easier to live in a polite society and get along with each other?
I don't know. I guess I hope – I like to think. I would prefer to live in a world where the language changes the way you think,
mm-hmm.
that in having to call an individual something more humanizing – that eventually you will see them in more human terms. But then again, I don't think any of us believe that language alone is the sole operator here. Like there,
right.
it has to come as part of a larger suite of social change instruments.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I'd agree with that and with what McWhorter is saying. But I guess the flip side of it is that we're accepting some truth of what Orwell is saying, and
mm-hmm.
that in many cases euphemisms are also going to corrupt clarity of thought, make us sort of dull and irresolute, and make it harder for us to resist evil. And so maybe the case is not about whether euphemisms are good or bad, but just that some euphemisms are more worthy than others.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, words are powerful, and
yeah.
the right euphemisms are also powerful. So all you can do is hope that whoever's in a position of power has the best words at their disposal. And on that cheerful note, let's end by just discussing a few favorite euphemisms. What are some of yours, Joe?
I love how you'll see this a lot in Europe. The bathroom, which is itself a euphemism,
mm-hmm.
is the WC.
It
has just been reduced to a couple of letters.
Like not even water closet, but
no,
just WC.
WC.
Okay. I like that.
Like WC Fields.
I don't know if it's quite a euphemism, but I have always been fond of the I don't know if he invented the phrase, but it certainly shows up in Shakespeare's Othello, making the beast with two backs as a euphemism or perhaps the opposite for sexual intercourse.
I don't know if that's a euphemism. That's fairly expressive.
It's expressive, but it definitely changes the meaning of the thing. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I guess it comes down to are there cases where you would say making the beast with two backs – and it would be more polite than saying they were having sexual intercourse, they were having sex.
I don't think that's the case. There must be another word for whatever that type of thing is, where you have a word or a phrase that means the same thing as something else, and it's not more polite, but it's just like more, I don't know, funnier?
Like making whoopee. I think that would be an example.
Okay.
Because whoopee is like, whoopee, it's fun, it's fun. Like if you were to say, okay, here are the three choices. Imagine you're in a roommate scenario and you have to say, oh, well, I walked in on my roommate And he and his partner were making the beast with two backs, like that. Or if you were to say, "Well, I walked in on my my roommate, and he and his partner were making whoopee," like which of the two? The two summoned vastly different images.
They're both highly polite.
Yes,
they're both incredibly generous.
All right. Well, I know everybody out there has their favorite euphemisms, and certainly some cross-cultural examples we'd love to hear. So you should definitely reach out to us about them. You can find us in a number of places, but the best starting point is to just go head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com, because that's where you'll find this podcast episode, all the other podcast episodes. You'll find blog posts, videos, and links out to our various social media accounts, such as Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, wherever you do your social media-ing, you will find us.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.